This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We'll visit with United States Attorney Brandon Freeman and former U.S. Attorney and Congressman Don Cashew. They'll discuss federal law enforcement in the Middle District of Louisiana. Big news regarding efforts to curb drug trafficking. And, of course, we'll reflect on the events of last week, which included a decision in the Alton Sterling case. Also, former state lawmaker Ben Bagger will remember his childhood friend Rusty Staub, the baseball great from New Orleans. Rusty Staub, who hit a homer in the majors at 19 and one at 41 years old, died last week at 73 in West Palm Beach, Florida. Veteran actress Judy Norton of the Waltons will talk about her resurgent career as well. And we have a big show coming. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Hope you had a very good Easter and Passover, and it's time for another week of programming. Glad you're with us. If you'd like to call 877-217-5757. Locally in Baton Rouge, 297-5633, and you can send us an email if you wish to talk@talklouisiana.org. In studio are Brandon Freeman, the U.S. Attorney for the Middle District of Louisiana. He was appointed in February of this year. And Don Cashew, the former U.S. Attorney, former congressman, and the founding partner of Cashew Ewing Law Firm, which is an underwriter for WRKF. So again, 877-217-5757. And two seasoned men. In fact, they worked together when Don Cashew was U.S. Attorney and Brandon Freeman was an assistant. And Don is a Democrat, Brandon is a Republican, and U.S. attorneys under every administration serve at the pleasure of the President of the United States of America. When did you know you were the guy under the new regime, Brandon Freeman?
Well, first of all, good morning. Thanks for having me. I learned back in the summer, late summer of last year, 2017, that Senator Cassidy intended to send my name up to the president for a potential nomination. And then that's what, at that point, it triggered the background investigation and the furtherance of that part of the process.
And Don Cashew, he, like you, is getting this gig at a relatively young age. You had already been a congressman, but still you were in your 40s, and Brandon is 43 years old. People may not realize it, but the U.S. attorney has a wide discretion. In fact, some have said the he or she, depending on what is going on in Washington and in Baton Rouge, is the most powerful person in the state. That's if you choose to call grand juries and indict people and put them in jail, which you often do, but sometimes they're public officials. It's not an easy job, is it?
No, it's not an easy job, Jim, and again, thank you for allowing us to be here today. But yeah, I mean, sometimes your biggest power is who you don't indict, and it takes a great deal of discretion, and I think Brandon is a perfect guy for that job. He's very reasonable. He's got the experience, and I think he's going to make us proud here.
In the old days, I used to get notice that somebody had received a target letter, and of course we would go with the story if we knew it to be true. There aren't that many leaks these days. How do you keep a lid on that stuff?
I think the folks at our office have historically taken that part of the process extraordinarily seriously. In fact, we had this discussion last week during the course of a run-up to some indictments that we'll have soon, and they just historically haven't had very many leaks come out of our office.
Now, if you get a target letter, that's quite an uncomfortable event. Our former Governor Edwin Edwards said he got about 22 of them over the course of his career, and he would go down to the courthouse and talk with the grand jury and the prosecutor, and he was only tried four times, only, so that means 18 times he gave enough credibility that he was not indicted. But his own attorney, Louis Unglesby, once told me, Jim, if you ever get a target letter, be very careful about going before the grand jury. You go in there without a lawyer, it's kind of a vulnerable situation, isn't it?
Sure, absolutely. It's I can't imagine after having opened that envelope what thoughts must go through someone's head. But, as Don said, we take our role in that process very seriously, and we don't send those things out without having having a strong basis to do so.
Well, why do you view this office as being essential and important to the citizens of our state and to the Middle District?
Sure, it's important for a lot of reasons, Jim. I think one of the primary reasons is we all know that there's a violent crime concern in the city and in the parish of East Baton Rouge. Now, that's not our only parish. We have eight others. But the office is important to that parish and others because I think it's 85% of law enforcement involvement comes from the city, state, and local levels. Our job is to supplement that 85% and do as much as we can to help the locals in their efforts to fight particular crime problems and their issues.
Now, both of you were chosen to be U.S. attorney, and this is a coveted job. What's the selection process like?
So for me, I can say that it started almost a year ago today. On April 7th last year, I got a call from someone who asked if I was interested in applying. I thought that was a good sign at the time, so I did so. Over the course of the summer, the local selection process started and concluded, and I ultimately was Senator Cassidy whittled it down to one person. Obviously, I was lucky enough to be that person. Which then triggered the larger background investigation by the FBI and then all the attendant business that comes from the Senate process as well.
Now, earlier, Don Cashew said the cases you don't prosecute are often tough calls as well. How do you make that choice, whether to go forward or not?
Well, for me, it's simple, and it started many years ago as a state prosecutor, quite frankly, prosecuting some of the lower-level misdemeanor and lower-level felony crimes. It's really quite simple. If the evidence is not there, if there's not sufficient admissible evidence to get a conviction, then you don't go forward. I teach that to a lot of the young prosecutors that I had under my charge over the various positions that I've had in management. There's no sense in going after a bad case that you can't prove. There are just too many good ones out there.
Well, on March 6th, as in last month, you announced the indictment of dozens of defendants who were accused of being part of a Baton Rouge area drug-based trafficking network. You're centering on drug prosecution. How significant is it going on in this community right now?
Unfortunately, it's worse, certainly worse than it should be. For me, one of the things that we discussed on day one when I met with our staff was that if we can take out one or two drug rings, one or two violent criminals during the course of our jobs, then we're making a difference, not just statistical differences, but we're making a difference for the mother who wants to let her 7-year-old ride the bicycle in front of the house in the neighborhood. I mean, that's a real result that I think we should attain.
One of the things that has changed over the last several years is that we don't have as many high-profile people being indicted and going to prison and having celebrated trials. So with that as the backdrop, is there a difference in the philosophy, or do we have fewer incidents of shenanigans going on in public life right now?
No, I don't think there's – hopefully there's fewer incidents of shenanigans, but for me – one of the things that I mentioned to our staff, it's obvious that there's a violent crime problem. Guns and drugs sort of go together. That's the mantra at this point of the department, right, nationwide. Mm-hmm. So it's important to me. But that's not to suggest that any other program in our office will suffer. If there's a public corruption problem, we're going to find out. We're going to figure it out, investigate it, and prosecute those people. Same with the white-collar criminals, fraudsters. There's a lot of healthcare fraud going on in this part of the world, and that's part of our charge as well. So, no, that's something that's a priority for us as well.
We're visiting with Brandon Freeman and Don Cashew, both attorneys. Prior to taking office as U.S. attorney earlier this year, Brandon served as director of the criminal division for the Louisiana Attorney General. And as we know, Don Cashew is not only a former U.S. congressman, but a former state representative. A law degree from Georgetown University and more than 20 years as a civil and criminal litigator. Don, you've been on both sides of the fence, Congressman. What is the major distinction between prosecuting somebody and defending a client?
Well, defending a client, your client normally walks in and says, look, I've either been subpoenaed, some records have been subpoenaed, or I've gotten a target letter, or they want me to testify. And 9 times out of 10, they'd say, I don't know why they want to talk to me. I didn't do anything. My warehouse was raided, but I didn't do anything. And So it's a puzzle. It's really kind of a challenge from a psychological standpoint to get past the resistance that people naturally have to admitting that they could have even done something wrong. So that's the biggest challenge. And you don't really have the cards. The prosecutors have the cards. And so it's kind of a negotiation first with your client and then with the U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI or whoever else is investigating it to try to figure out how to best resolve the matter.
Well, one thing I didn't mention about Brandon is that he was a Marine, if there is any past tense to this. How did that happen?
Yeah, that was something that was of interest to me as a young boy. I think in the 7th or 8th grade is when I took an interest in the Marine Corps. It sort of stayed, that fire stayed lit until I was of age, and that's when I signed up to go off into the Marines. I ultimately joined the Marine Corps, did 6 years in the reserve, and it was a great, great time in my life.
How old were you when you enlisted?
I first enlisted at 17, but was sidelined.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. I first enlisted at 17, but was sidelined for a couple of years after a knee surgery, and then ultimately went back in.
Where did you do your basic training?
In California, in San Diego, California.
You were a Hollywood Marine.
That's
right?
What they say, right?
Yeah. That's where Tony Perkins went.
That's right.
And Tony Perkins, by the way, has a tattoo because of his Marine service there. When he ran for the U.S. Senate in 2002 against Mary Landrieu and Susie Terrell and John Cooksey, he was the only tattooed candidate. And it was because of his Marine service. I assume that you may have some, but that's a topic for another day.
I'll keep my jacket
but
on.
But you look like you've stayed in shape. And I must say that some of these law enforcement people are in fabulous condition. Others are not. Is it important to have in-shape police officers and sheriff's deputies?
I think it's important to have an in-shape society, quite frankly.
I'm with you on that.
Yeah. Good answer.
If we're going to make America great again. We'll be back after this time out on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. Becca Dill and Ali Baltazar producing. Brandon Freeman and Don Cashew are with us. Brandon is the new U.S. attorney for the Middle District of Louisiana. So if some kind of criminal activity is going on in Baton Rouge at the state capitol or somewhere else, it's his office that handles the prosecution. Don Cashew held that post. He also was a state representative and a U.S. congressman, and is now practicing law with the Cashew Ewing Law Firm. 877-217-5757. David in Atlanta. David, you're on the air with Brandon and Don. Hi, David.
Good morning, gentlemen. I'd like to ask the attorneys, how can the mayor of a city in Louisiana get away with giving himself and none of his political pals health and life insurance for life without council approval, have the Louisiana Attorney General, Buddy Caldwell, rule it was illegal, and the U.S. Attorney in New Orleans took no action of any kind whatsoever, and I'm talking about the confessed federal felon, Aaron Broussard.
All right. Well, Broussard actually went to jail for a good while, but sometimes you make a call on whether something is valid to go to court with, and other times you don't, and I don't know if this has ever went before a grand jury. But if somebody has a complaint, what do they do? What's the best way to contact you, or should they? Do you like whistleblowers?
It's a good question. The first thing they should do is contact a local law enforcement. Local law enforcement is very good at making a determination of whether a charge or an allegation is and best should be handled at the state level or a local level. And if not, they can forward you on to the proper agency, proper federal agency that can handle those cases.
877-217-5757, Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Hi, Phil. You're on with Don Cashew and Brandon Freeman, the U.S. attorney.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
I just want to say that it's been a pleasure to deal with the jury selection process. I got called to go serve or to be in the jury pool, and it's just, they're very well handled. The people were sensible, and also it was almost a pleasure to be there. So my compliments
almost
to you all
a pleasure.
On that. And my question is, what do you think about the unanimous jury thing that's being talked about right now? Thank you.
Yeah, it's a good question, Phil. First of all,
that's only in state court, right?
That's right.
It's not in your court.
Right. In federal court, we already have a unanimous jury system. So every case that is tried in federal court, irrespective of the charge is and must be convicted by a unanimous jury. I think what he's talking about is the article that we saw maybe earlier this morning regarding state juries.
Right now, Louisiana is one of only two states where you can actually be convicted without a unanimous decision. David McIntyre asks, can you ask Don and Brandon if over the last few decades of drug policy in the U.S., has there been a decline in the actual use of drugs by Americans? Basically, he writes, if putting all these people behind bars and relating drugs and guns has actually produced any less use of drugs. That's from David McIntyre.
I think it's an interesting question, David, and frankly, I don't have the numbers. I would like to think that it's making a difference. I think awareness helps to make a difference. For me, it's a fight worth having because, you know, for an example, a very close personal friend of mine has a daughter who grew up in Baton Rouge, went to a very good school, and was a promising young lady, and I think after her 18th birthday, got hooked on heroin. And it changed her life. She's recovering and doing very well, but it's a fight worth having.
All right, here's a question from Holly in the Garden District asking about sanctuary cities. That's been an issue in New Orleans. Is it an issue in this district?
I don't believe it is. I think we've had great partnerships with the states, state and local law enforcement agencies. I don't think they have any problems in terms of cooperating with the federal authorities when it comes to immigration matters.
What about immigration on other fronts?
Yeah, in my experience, and so when I worked for Mr. Cadieu at the office in 2012, some of the cases he had me handling were immigration matters, and those cases were like every other case. We tried them on the merits, and we brought those charges where they were appropriate.
All right, here's one from Ann. What can be done to keep citizens safe in schools, churches, and everyday life?
That's a really good question, Ann, and I think it all starts with awareness. We need to keep mindful of what's going on in our surroundings. I think, it goes back to, I forget who coined the phrase, but if you see it, say it. It's one of those things where you have to report crime or criminal activity or even suspicious activity if you want the authorities to get involved.
Don, what about it?
Well, I agree with Brandon. I think, here in the Middle District and particularly in East Baton Rouge where we've had problems, Hiller Moore has been really instrumental in trying to make community policing more effective and more widespread. He instituted the BRAVE program. I think it's being maybe renamed and rebranded for a variety of reasons. But I think trying to look at it as a community problem and dealing with it in that way to focus on trying to, get some of these kids out of the gangs and give them some potential outs to get out of their drug-related, activities.
Jim, one of the things our office did recently in with respect to that question, I think it was Ann's question, is we held a training for churches all across the state, houses of worship is what we called it, all across the state, including any denomination from any faith and any background, and it included some law enforcement. And we tried to educate them on how they could make their churches safer for the flock, so to speak, and then for the people in their community. Because as you know, those leaders in those communities touch a wide cross section of the folks in their community, and they're a very good outlet for helping keep communities safe.
Last week, we had a decision in the Sterling case from the Attorney General. No charges against the officers. Plain Salamone, the officer who fired the fatal shots, was dismissed from the force Friday by Murphy Paul, the chief of police, and the other officer, Howie Lake, was suspended for 3 days. But how did this case end up with the U.S. Attorney's Office?
That's a good question. Typically, what happens in those types of cases is, and I believe historically, Louisiana State Police would take the lead on that case. The decision was made very early on for the federal government to get involved. I'm not exactly sure what went into that. I didn't have any part of that process at the time. At the time, as you know, I was working for the Attorney General as Director of the Criminal Division. So when that occurred, it was at that point left to the federal government to make its decision, as you all know. Shortly thereafter, I think within about 72 hours, the local district attorney, Hiller Moore, for personal reasons, recused his office, which then triggered the involvement of the Louisiana Attorney General.
Now, the Attorney General decided no charges, but he did so without a grand jury. He's getting some pushback on this. What goes into deciding whether to impanel a grand jury?
Generally speaking, if a prosecutor, again, generally speaking, believes that he doesn't have enough evidence to bring a case forward, I'm not sure that it would be prudent to bring it to a grand jury. Now, that's my own personal thoughts on it. And that may have been a factor going into what Mr. Landry decided.
And Jim, just to answer that, in the state system, grand juries are only have to be impaneled in capital offenses or offenses punishable by life. All the other cases, it's discretionary. Most of the times, the DA institutes charges by a bill of information, as opposed to the federal system where all felonies have to go through a grand jury. So that's kind of I think that's maybe a mistaken belief that we need to send things to the grand jury in all cases. That's just not the case in the state system.
It took 10 months for the Attorney General to make his decision. Do you know why it took so long?
I don't, and I know Brandon can't comment. But it's a hard, you know, that was a hard case, and I think it sounds like they really looked at the evidence very closely. They probably talked to a variety of experts, probably conducted their own investigation as well. So, you know, 10 months, yeah, it's not a short time, but it's also, you know, I think it was sufficient time and nothing out of the ordinary.
Well, thanks to both of you gentlemen for your service to the community and the state and the country. Brandon Freeman, congratulations. Good luck to you, and hope we can have you back.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Don Cashew.
Thank you, Jim.
And we'll return with Ben Baggert, former state lawmaker, on the life and times of Rusty Staub after this pause for the news. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number, and we should be joined, things go according to plan, very shortly by Ben Baggert, former state lawmaker. He spent about a quarter century in the Louisiana legislature, now a prominent lawyer in New Orleans, and that's what he's doing today and taking a break if we are fortunate enough to talk with us about Rusty Staub, who started his major league career at the age of 19 out of Jesuit High School with the Houston Colt 45s, 1963. He homered when he was all of 19 years old in the majors, and he finished his career with the New York Mets in 1985 when he was 41 years old, and Rusty Staub hit a home run then. So he is the one of the few people to homer as a teenager and as a 40-year-old in the major leagues. If you'd like to talk about this, 877-217-5757. Last week, Le Grand Orange, as Rusty was known, died at the age of 73 in West Palm Beach, Florida. He had been in poor health for some time, and one of those who knew him well was the former state lawmaker, Ben Baggert. It was kind of a who's who class at Jesuit High School in New Orleans on Carrollton Avenue back in the day. Their group also included Pat Skrein, the celebrated LSU quarterback who became mayor of this city at the age of 37, and died in 1994, tragically, at 51 years old. Jim Donnellan was in that group, the insurance commissioner, as are many others who have excelled in public life and in private life. And Ben Baggert, good morning to you.
Oh, good morning to you, Jim. I wish I had excelled like Rusty, because he was one of the rare humanitarians that ever existed. People remember him for all of his baseball exploits, but in New York and in other big towns that he played in, he occupies a place similar to that of Drew Brees here in New Orleans. He's just adored in places like that, and everyone knows him.
Well, he had two different iterations of his restaurant, Rusty's, in New York City. He was an accomplished chef, appropriate for a kid from New Orleans. You knew him when he was a teenager. Was he into these kinds of things beyond athletics when he was a kid?
My first memory of Rusty was we were about 11 or 12, and my little league team played his little league team. And I just remember this not very athletic-looking kid coming to the plate. I was a catcher. And, back then we would try to distract and razz the batter, and I was giving him a lot of chatter and a lot of grief. And he just stood up to the plate and didn't look like he could hit the ball. And by his just the way he guarded the plate, it was as if to say, this is my plate, and you're not going to put anything in the strike zone that I'm not going to hit. And by golly, he hit everything that came into the strike zone. And he did, at the time he wasn't very, very strong. He developed late, and of course he was younger than a lot of us. He and I were two of the youngest guys to graduate from Jesuit. Actually, yesterday would have been his birthday.
Yep.
He'd be 74 yesterday.
That is correct.
But I remember when he made contact with the ball, it was with such precision, and he got so much, as they say, wood on the ball, that even as a child, as a 12-year-old, he hit the ball like a man. The ball would travel fast and far and hard, and he rarely missed. I could tell that he was something special, even though we were only about 11 or 12 years old.
We played 23 major league seasons. Not many people have done that. Only one postseason with the Mets in 1973, and the Mets that year made the postseason, winning the National League East with just 82 wins, and then they beat the Cincinnati Reds, who had won 99 games in the West, and it was largely because of Staub, who homered three times in four games. And then in the World Series, which the Mets lost in seven games to the Oakland A's, Rusty batted .423. So he did well when the spotlight was on him. And you knew him when he was this fresh-faced, red-headed kid at Jesuit High School. And this is an amazing story. Ben Baggert, Rusty Staub, and Blaze Starr, the stripper, were together. What happened to precipitate this?
Well, back in those days, Earl Long was the governor, and poor fella had lost his mind. He had some organic brain disease, and they had committed him. And it was an international story that the governor of a state had been committed to a mental hospital. Well, he was pretty savvy, and he managed to escape. And when he did, one of the many unusual things that he did, he took up with a Bourbon Street stripper who was just an incredibly beautiful woman named Blaze Starr, and they made a movie about it, which was filmed at the Capitol about 30 years ago, starring Paul Newman as mm-hmm. Earl Long. But anyway,
he looked just like him, didn't he?
Nothing like him. But we used to go to Mass and Communion in the morning, and back in those days, good Catholic boys were told that if you had an impure thought, that was a mortal sin. And if you died with a mortal sin on your soul, you'd go straight to hell.
That's right.
So
you had to go to confession.
You had to go to confession to get it removed. And Rusty and I had served Mass and had gone to Communion that morning. And after baseball practice that afternoon, we had our Jesuit uniforms on, and everybody stopped to pick up a kid who was hitchhiking with a Jesuit uniform. All of a sudden, this car comes up and says, "Get in, kid." So we jumped in the car, and I was in the front seat. Somehow Rusty was in the back, and I was admiring the chrome and the push buttons and the shiny glitter, leather seats, and Rusty kept punching me from the back seat. And I turned, to make a fist as if to say, I'm going to rap you if you don't stop punching me. You know how kids are.
Uh-huh.
And he had this peculiar expression on his face, and he was pointing at the driver. And then I noticed the driver was incredibly good-looking woman, even though we were only about 13 or 14 years old. She was in a sundress and scantily clad, and she had high heel shoes on that were colorless, and I couldn't stop staring at her. And she turned to me and she said, you like what you're looking at, kid? And I remember clearly my reply was, I'm not looking at nothing. And I certainly was. And Rusty was behind me, and he said, you are looking. You're staring at Blaze Starr. Well, she was all over the newspaper every day. She and her along were doing something different and on TV and radio, and we all knew what she looked like. I just didn't notice at first. So she dropped us off, and we were now on another street hitchhiking, and Rusty was concerned about my soul, as he always was concerned about people. Mm-hmm. And I can remember him asking me, my state of grace was crumbling while I was looking at this woman. And he asked me, Benny, are you still in the state of grace? And that really says, first of all, it's a sweet little childhood memory, but it says a lot about Rusty's personality. He was always caring for other people. For example, after 9/11, my daughter, who was working on Wall Street, found herself in a makeshift cafeteria serving food to the workers at Ground Zero. And one of the people very nearby her kept getting a lot of attention from other people, and she quickly learned it was Rusty Staub. And she went up to him and she says, I think you know my father. He says he played Little League baseball against you and was a catcher at Jesuit. And he said, you're Benny's daughter. And he picked her up and kissed her. And it was another sweet little story, but it shows the humanitarian aspects of Rusty. And in the end, his uncle died as a motorcycle patrolman while in the line of duty. And after Rusty retired, he formed a charity that took care of widows and children of police officers and first responders who died in the line of duty. That charity he formed was in the 80s, but by 2001, he'd raised at least $10 million to assist the survivors of those first responders. Well, boy, when 9/11 came, his charity was there, and Rusty raised over $100 million for the responders of 9/11. So my daughter, who was still working on Wall Street in the ensuing year, called and said, Dad, could you come? My company has bought a table at Rusty's event that he's putting on at the Grand Ballroom of the Hilton, and it would be good for me if they could see that my father knew Rusty Staub because she was 15. Well, she called later and she said, "We don't have a ticket for you. You can't come." So I called Rusty and he said, "Sure, come sit up at the desk with
there
me."
There you go.
And, well, and, he was quite a humanitarian, and everyone loved him. But in baseball, few people got on base in the history of Major League Baseball as many times as Rusty. Rusty got on base more times than Joe DiMaggio, Roger Hornsby, and a lot of the others.
That's right. And I remember the late, great Hap Gaudy. Every night he would say what Rusty did, wherever Rusty was playing. That would be in the sportscast at WWL. Ben, thanks for remembering. Le Grand Orange, Rusty Staub, Daniel Rusty Staub, pride of Jesuit High School. Thanks, Ben.
Okay, Jim.
See you soon. We're back after this pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Allie Baltazar and Becca Dill are producing, and your number, as always, is 877-217-5757. Always nice to hear from Ben Baggert, remembering Rusty Staub, who died last week at the age of 73 and was famous at 19 as a major league starter, first baseman, Houston Astros, outfielder as well, and he played for 23 major league seasons. We're joined now by an actress who was famous before she was 19 years old, Judy Norton. Many of us remember her on The Waltons, and she is hardly resting on her laurels. And it is always a pleasure to share the microphone with you, Judy Norton. Good morning to you.
evening. How are you?
Doing well. Joining us early in Los Angeles. But we've talked before. How was it being known literally worldwide, but certainly in the United States and in your hometown and everywhere you went? Everyone knew you were Mary Ellen. How was that experience?
Well, it was an interesting time because in the 70s, we didn't have all of the social media. And so things were a little more contained. We were able to live a little, you know, fairly normal life. And because the Waltons was not, it was a film show. We weren't taped in front of a live audience. So by the time an episode was on TV, we were months removed from it. And it was really quite a while before we started getting a sense of the impact the show was having on the country, on, you know, around the world. And then I think we were kind of a little surprised, you know, at times to go out and you know, and get that kind of recognition. So I loved the work. I loved the people I was working with. We were really proud of the show. So, you know, it was great. I mean, it was a great way to grow up for me.
Well, it also is a hard void to fill after it's over. And some people, as we know, have had real problems with that. You've gone on with your career, but in those days, you know, today a huge audience on television's 20 million, you were getting more than that every week, weren't you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, with only three networks on, really three networks that people were watching regularly, we were pulling easily 30% of a viewing audience, over 30% every Thursday night. So, it was a great time in television to be doing a series because it did create such a great foundation to build a career on. So I feel like I was very fortunate.
But how challenging was it when the role of Mary Ellen ended for you?
Oh, anytime you do a show like that where you are so recognizable, it's a double-edged sword because being that well identified with a particular character, you know, I would definitely would run into the, oh, well, we know her, she's great, but everybody knows her and identifies with that role. So there were certainly, you know, circumstances where producers were unwilling to hire me for other things because they felt that, yeah, that the audience would just see me in another role and still think Mary Ellen Walton. So, you know, when the series ended, I went back to sort of my theater roots, which sounds funny, you know, in my early 20s, but I had been doing theater since I was, you know, like 6 years old. So, and I had been starting to really develop a love of musical theater. So I went back and started doing, you know, just theater across the country and both musical and non-musical shows and started working on building other aspects of my career where my name would be valuable because in theater it was sort of like, oh, they wanted someone recognizable that would pull in an audience. So I just was always looking for not which door was closed, but which door was open.
Yeah, and you became a producer, a writer, and, of course, a star. And that those roles are combined in your latest work, a film, a suspense film, Inclusion Criteria. Tell us more about Inclusion Criteria.
Well, as you mentioned, it's a suspense thriller. I play a character named Kara, who has been sort of an introverted loner most of her life, and she's put in a circumstance where she's uncertain whether she is literally losing her mind, her sanity, or whether she is being stalked in some fashion. You know, things start happening in her environment that she can't explain, and she's not sure if it's her doing it and not remembering or whether it is someone else, you know, trying to drive her to think that she's going insane. So as you said, I wrote it, and I'm starring in it, and then I, because it was a project I developed with Josh Hodgins, my co-producer and writer, I mean director on the project. You know, I was able to be involved in all other aspects of the film as well, which was a wonderful challenge and gratifying to, you know, to be able to retain input on the direction that the film went, like, you know, throughout the filming of it.
The guest is Judy Norton. She was star of the Waltons as a child, the oldest daughter, and of course, synonymous with Richard Thomas. And what a cast you had for that show. And now she is Tara Malone in Inclusion Criteria. She, Tara, is creative, a loner, somewhat insecure. Are there qualities about Tara that are embodied in you?
I mean, any character I build, I have to find those aspects within myself to play the character. But, you know, it can be more, you know, what intimidates me, what, you know, I mean, I wouldn't say, I'm kind of a mix of an introvert and an extrovert, you know. I'm not, you know, I always envy the people that, you know, walk into a room and they are, you know, the life of the party, you know, and I'm not quite that. I'm not that sort of big in a, you know, in a room, but I can be, you know, I think that's the performer in me. So, but you know, it's not autobiographical in any sense, you know. It was a story that I was fascinated by. First, it was based off of something I had heard in the news, you know, and read about, and I can't tell you what it is or it gives away the story, but, you know, it was just a kernel that kind of stuck there that, wow, I wonder if this scenario, you know, how plausible this is, and is this really happening? And it was very disturbing to me. So I had mentioned it to Josh one day over lunch, and he went, I love that, you know. And so we ended up developing it. And
very good.
Yeah.
Judy Norton is our guest, and a listener, Tracy, at the Capitol in Baton Rouge, asks if you were ever sexually harassed as an actress. We've had multiple cases of this reported. And were you in that number? Did you have to fight that battle as well?
Yeah, I mean, not to the degree that I have heard other women, you know, express. But yeah, I don't think there's a single actress friend of mine that I have spoken to, and in some cases, men as well, that, you know, that haven't had some sort of experience, you know, unfortunately. And you know, it's incredibly prevalent in this business, but not just this business. You know, I think there are just far too many men and women who abuse their power and victimize people that are not in a, you know, feel they are not in a position to withstand that. But, you know, it's good that, you know, light is being shed on it, and hopefully some of these people will recognize that this kind of behavior is just unacceptable. And as the victims become more empowered, then I think it will happen less, because people will feel that they can say no and that there are other options, you know, that they can speak out and not become the effect of it by saying no.
We only have about 30 seconds, but another listener, Skip, asks about Mary Ellen, Judy Norton, posing for Playboy. Was that a tough decision?
Yeah. You know, I had several representatives over the course of a few years, you know, recommend it and suggest it and advise me in that direction. So, you know, I was young, and I felt that, you know, if I had hired experienced professionals to help guide my career, that, you know, I should listen to them. So, you know, had I been more experienced in the business, I'd probably, it would sound funny, since I'd been in it since I was a kid, I don't think I would have made that choice, because I don't think it was necessarily a good career choice. I don't.
Okay, we do have to roll. But Judy Norton, congratulations on inclusion criteria and keeping your vast talents alive and well. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. And we're back tomorrow, same time, same place. Until then, I'm Jim Inkster. Stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.